Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts today, Becca Brown, here with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hello, Becca, and hello to you, the listener. It's good to have you with us. Yesterday in Ames, voters were asked to approve a bond issue to support construction of a convention center at Iowa State University Center to be jointly owned by the city and Iowa State University and the renovation of the Scheman Building at ISU. Results from the special election were reported by the Ames Tribune this morning. The measure failed by 63% against 37% in favor. Only 11.7% of Ames voters turned out to vote. Warren Madden, Senior Vice President for Business and Finance at Iowa State University, said it was still a need to at least bring the Scheman Building, which hasn't received a major renovation since it was built four decades ago, up to modern standards. But there hadn't been any conversations yet about revisiting the issue. The Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau Director, Julie Weeks, said that the Bureau was obviously disappointed with the results, but thanked the volunteers and voters who recognized the partnership between the university and the city. The board of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau has been working on this for 5 years, Weeks said, and I doubt that they'll bring it back. We've pretty much gotten a significant direction from this.
Well, I have a weather update today. If you didn't have hope before, don't fear. There is more hope in the future of weather. Today, it's going to be cloudy, but tomorrow, Thursday, it should get brighter and be partly sunny with a high near 33. Yay! Wind will be coming in from the south, and gusts can get as high as 21 miles an hour. However, the wind chill can go as low as 5, but that's still in the positives.
Yep.
Not negative. Thursday night, it will be mostly cloudy with a low of 24. On Friday, we can expect a 20% chance of rain or freezing rain. We're graduating from snow, so that's great. So that'll be before noon, and then, well, there's a chance of snow. Darn. But warming up a bit to about 36 degrees. Saturday will be partly sunny with a high near 27, and on Sunday it will be sunny with a high near 39.
Mm-hmm.
Yay. Monday and Tuesday are predicted to be sunny. On Monday we got a high of 47 degrees, and that is a big difference between February and March.
Indeed. Thank you, Becca. We often start Local Talk by noting the unfolding of the natural, animal, and plant world. Our phenology report today takes note of a fact that this year, 2014, is the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, once the most numerous bird in America. Noted conservationist Stanley Temple will deliver a lecture tomorrow, March 6, on the subject, The Extinction of the Passenger Pigeon. The lecture will be held at the Great Hall at Iowa State University's Memorial Union. Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's correspondent from the Department of Natural Resources, has filed this report.
Phenology is chronicling nature's happenings like the first hepatica of spring or the last osprey of autumn. Today's focus on phenology is an anniversary of the extinction of a wildlife species. 100 years ago, in 1914, the last passenger pigeon died. Its story will be included in a presentation by noted conservation biologist Dr. Stanley Temple at 7 p.m. Thursday, March 6th. In the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. You'll want to hear The Extinction of the Passenger Pigeon, Lessons from the Past for a Sustainable Future. Dr. Temple is an emeritus professor of conservation biology with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is senior fellow and science advisor with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Aldo Leopold is the father of wildlife conservation and an environmental giant of the 20th century. Dr. Temple's talk marks the centennial of the extinction of the passenger pigeon in 1914, and it looks at the distorted view that wildlife resources went on forever. Temple uses the case of the passenger pigeon to call attention to the world's ongoing extinction crisis and our relationship with other species. But first, here's a little background on passenger pigeons. The common name passenger pigeon derives from the French word passager, which means to pass by in a fleeting manner. It seems the passenger pigeon lived up to its name of being here, then in a short span of history, passed by in a fleeting manner, literally. They were here, then gone in the blink of an eye. September 1st, 1914, Martha, the last passenger pigeon, and it was captive, died at the Cincinnati Zoo. She outlasted by 4 years, the penultimate survivor of her species, George, and her only companion. As news spread of her species' imminent extinction, Martha became a tourist attraction. In her final years, whether depressed or just old, she barely moved. Underwhelmed zoo visitors threw fistfuls of sand at her to elicit a reaction. When she finally died, her body was taken to the Cincinnati Ice Company, frozen in a 300-pound ice cube, and shipped by train to the Smithsonian Institution in our nation's capital. The fact that we can pinpoint the death of the last known passenger pigeon is one of many peculiarities that distinguish this species. Many thousands of species go extinct every year, but we tend to be unaware of their passing. The passenger pigeon's decline was impossible to ignore because as recently as the 1880s, it was the most numerous vertebrate in North America. It made up as much as 40% of the continent's bird population. In the book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, Joel Greenberg suggests that the species population may have exceeded that of every other bird on Earth. Their flocks expanded to a mile wide and extended 300 miles beyond the horizon. They were so dense that they darkened the sky for hours as the flock passed overhead. In 1860, a naturalist observed a single flock that he estimated to contain 3.7 billion passenger pigeons. By comparison, there are currently 260 million pigeons, or rock doves, in our cities and countryside today. Probably the most terrible example of mass slaughter in the history of wildlife was not the bison, but the passenger pigeon, a story that almost defies belief. Buffalo and eagles were severely persecuted, but the unmitigated sloth and greed imposed upon passenger pigeons was unparalleled in human history. The early Europeans in North America frequently commented on the huge numbers of blue, long-tailed, fast and graceful pigeons in the country. One of the first settlers in Virginia wrote, "There are wild pigeons in winter beyond number or imagination. Myself have seen 3 or 4 hours together flocks in the air, so thick that even have they shadowed the sky from us." As late as 1854 in Wayne County, New York, a local resident wrote, "There would be days and days when the air was alive with them, hardly a break occurring in the flocks for half a day at a time. Flocks stretch as far as a person could see, one tier above another, as powerful as lightning in the sky." On April 8, 1873, at Saginaw in Michigan, there was a continuous stream of passenger pigeons overhead between 7:30 in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Other reports describe flocks a mile wide flying overhead for 4 or 5 hours at a time during their migration in the spring from the south to their breeding areas in New England, New York, Ohio, and the southern Great Lakes area. The flocks were so thickly packed that a single shot could bring down 30 or 40 birds, and many were killed simply by hitting them with pieces of wood as they flew over hilltops. A single passenger pigeon nesting area in Wisconsin was once occupied an expanse as large as 850 square miles. That is nearly 30 miles by 30 miles, from Ames bounded on the west to beyond Ogden and north to Webster City, that contained primarily one nesting species, passenger pigeons. Nesting colonies attracted large numbers of predators, including minks, weasels, and raccoons that preyed on eggs and nestlings. Predatory birds such as owls, hawks, and eagles preyed on nestlings and adults, and wolves, foxes, bobcats, bears, and cougars preyed on injured adults and fallen nestlings. Exhibitors like Cooper's hawk and goshawks and falcons like merlins and peregrines pursued and preyed upon pigeons in flight. The flocks in turn executed complex aerial maneuvers to avoid these predators, assimilating giant slinky toys in the sky. It is believed that the large concentration of passenger pigeons were based on the anti-predator benefits of very large numbers. While many predators were drawn to the flocks, individual pigeons were largely protected due to the sheer size of the flock. Overall, little damage could be inflicted on the flock by predation. Despite the number of predators, nesting colonies were so large that they were estimated to have a 90% success rate of fledging their one young. The passenger pigeon was an excellent flyer and is estimated to have averaged 62 miles per hour during migration. It flew with quick, repeated flaps that increased the bird's velocity the closer the wings got to the body. It was equally as adept and quick at flying through a forest as through open space. A flock was also adept at following the lead of the pigeon in front of it, and flocks swerved together to avoid a predator. At roosting sites, the passenger pigeons packed so densely on branches that even thick ones often broke under the collective weight. They often piled on top of each other's backs to roost. By the mid-1800s, railroads had opened new opportunities for pigeon shooters. While previously it proved too difficult to ship masses of pigeons to eastern cities, the access provided by the railroad permitted pigeon shooting to become commercialized. After being opened up to the railroads, the town of Plattsburgh, New York, is reported to have shipped 1.8 million pigeons to larger cities in 1851 alone, at a price of 31 cents a dozen. If you're a fan of crime movies, you may have wondered about the origin of the phrase stool pigeon. Shooters would tie a captured and usually blinded passenger pigeon to a small stool, then drop it onto the ground. Members of the flock overhead would see the stool pigeon, or live decoy, and interpret this as a signal to land on the ground themselves. They were then easily captured by nets, or were literally sitting ducks for the shooters. A species extinction is an important matter, but the sheer numbers of this once prolific bird is mind-boggling. Our forefathers granted us many luxuries and afforded us many beautiful creations. However, they really missed the point that wildlife species would not go on forever. Conservation measures are important when it comes to humankind and nature. Passenger pigeons' incredible abundance was an enticement to overexploitation and mass slaughter. The birds were shot for their meat, which was sold by the ton, and for their oil and feathers. Even so, the rapid decline from approximately 5 billion to zero within a few decades baffled most Americans. Science magazine published an article by skeptics claiming that the birds had all fled to the Arizona desert. Others hypothesized that the pigeon had taken refuge in the Chilean pine forests, or somewhere east of Puget Sound, or in Australia. Another theory held that every passenger pigeon had joined a single mega flock and had disappeared into the Bermuda Triangle. But it was reality. Passenger pigeons were going, gone. You don't often read it in the popular accounts, but some forward-thinking Americans did try to save passenger pigeons. However, the Ohio State Legislature dismissed one such petition in 1857, saying that the passenger pigeon needs no protection. Wonderfully prolific, having the vast forests of the North as its breeding grounds, traveling hundreds of miles in search of food, it is here today and elsewhere tomorrow, and no ordinary destruction can lessen them. Operative term there being ordinary destruction. By the late 1880s, the trade of passenger pigeons had become industrialized. Large commission houses employed trappers to follow the flocks of pigeons year-round. In 1874, at least 600 individuals were employed as pigeon trappers, a number which grew to 1,200 by 1881. Pigeons were so commonplace that by 1876, shipments of dead pigeons were unable to recoup the costs of the barrels and ice needed to ship them, which led to the pigeons being caught alive instead. And a netting industry unfolded. Large flocks and communal breeding made the species highly vulnerable to extinction as a result of this exploitation. As the flocks dwindled in size, populations decreased below the threshold necessary to propagate the species. Naturalist Paul R. Ehrlich wrote that the passenger pigeon extinction illustrates a very important principle of conservation biology. It is not always necessary to kill the last pair of a species to force it into extinction. Some have suggested cloning the passenger pigeon in the future. De-extinction efforts are now underway to revive the species by extracting DNA fragments from preserved specimens and later using band-tailed pigeons as surrogate parents. A significant challenge to an effective de-extinction effort is the fact that the passenger pigeon was a very social bird, known to form flocks of millions. When their numbers dwindled to a few thousand, the birds stopped breeding. it is likely that more than 1,000 birds would have to be recreated in order for a de-extinction effort to be successful. Also, the pigeons that raise them would be a different species with differing mothering techniques. It is what it is. Passenger pigeons known to the planet blinked out. This is a very significant speaker and spokesperson of our era, Dr. Stan Temple, 7 p.m. Thursday, March 6th, Great Hall in the Memorial Union on the ISU campus. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM. Now a speech entitled On a Monument to the Pigeon by Aldo Leopold, presented in 1947 at Wyalusing State Park in Wisconsin at the confluence of the Wisconsin River into the Mississippi River. The monument was near the site where the last passenger pigeon was shot at Babcock, Wisconsin in September 1899. This species became extinct through the avarice and thoughtlessness of man.
This monument, perched like a duck hawk on its cliff, will scan this wide valley, watching through the days and years. For many a march it will watch the geese go by, telling the river about clearer, colder, lonelier waters on the tundra. For many an April it will see the red buds come and go, and for many a May the flush of oak blooms on 1,000 hills. Questing wood ducks will search these basswoods for hollow limbs. Golden prothonotaries will shake golden pollen from the river willows. Egrets will pose on these sloughs in August. Plovers will whistle from September skies. Hickory nuts will plop into October leaves, and hail will rattle in November woods. But no pigeons will pass, for there are no pigeons, save only this flightless one, graven in bronze on this rock. Tourists will read this inscription, but their thoughts will not take wing. We are told by economic moralists that to mourn the pigeon is mere nostalgia, that if the pigeoners had not done away with him, the farmers would ultimately have been obliged, in self-defense, to do so. This is one of those peculiar truths that are valid, but not for the reasons alleged. The pigeon was a biological storm. He was the lightning that played between two opposing potentials of intolerable intensity, the fat of the land and the oxygen for the air. The fat of the land and the oxygen of the air. Yearly the feathered tempest roared up, down, and across the continent, sucking up the laden fruits of forest and prairie, burning them in a traveling blast of life. Like any other chain reaction, the pigeon could survive no diminution of its own furious intensity. When the pigeoners subtracted from his numbers and the pioneers chopped gaps in the continuity of his fuel, his flame guttered out with hardly a sputter or even a wisp of smoke. Today the oaks still flaunt their burden at the sky, but the feathered lightning is no more. Worm and weevil must now perform slowly and silently the biological task that once drew thunder from the firmament. The wonder is not that the pigeon went out, but that he never survived through all the millennia of pre-Babitan time. The pigeon loved his land. He lived by the intensity of his desire for clustered grape and bursting beech nut, and by his contempt of miles and seasons. Whatever Wisconsin did not offer him gratis today, he sought and found tomorrow in Michigan or Labrador or Tennessee. His love was for present things, and these things were present somewhere. To find them required only the free sky and the will to ply his wings. To love what was is a new thing under the sun, unknown to most people and to all pigeons. To see America as history, to conceive of destiny as a becoming, to smell a hickory tree through the still lapse of ages. All these things are possible for us, and to achieve them takes only the free sky and the will to ply our wings. In these things, and not in Mr. Bush's bombs and Mr. DuPont's nylons, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts.
I am one of your hosts, Becca Brown, here with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. We just listened to a report put together by Pat Schlarbaum on the passenger pigeon, whose dramatic story highlights the ongoing species extinction crisis.
And the reader we heard at the end was James Winter, who is a KHOI volunteer and reader extraordinaire. We have been joined in the studio by Naomi Friend. Naomi is an artist and student at Iowa State, soon to graduate, I understand.
That's right.
Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you.
So your work is currently on exhibit at the Stomping Ground Cafe in Ames. I saw it there and I found it riveting. The works are mostly a combination of watercolors and prints of photographs on paper and canvas. Is that correct?
Yeah, and also wood.
And wood, that's right. One of the images is also on cloth, strung up like a clothesline.
Yeah, I'm working on a bunch of different materials right now, but always with alternative photography processes and painting and drawing.
So the images that stand out mostly in my memory are landscapes of Iowa, primarily rural, old farmhouses, barns, and people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a powerful message of land and heritage. So who are these people and what are these places?
Yeah, I grew up in Iowa, so the landscape is really central to me, and I think, you know, looking out over the horizon and seeing the large sky, that's something I've grown up with.
Where did you grow up?
In northwest Iowa, in Sioux Center. Growing up, looking across the plains, I think that's a big part of my aesthetic. So the imagery I'm working with is a lot of photos that I've taken of my grandmother's farm in southwest Minnesota. And I'm also using images from, like, local images from around here as well. The photos that I take are all about my personal history, so they could be pictures of my family members. I have some historical pictures of when my great-grandfather settled the farm back in the homestead era. So, yeah, that's the kind of stuff I'm working with.
Did you grow up on a farm?
I did not. I actually grew up in town. Yeah, my mom grew up on a farm, and her mother. So the farming was a really big part of my mom's side of the family. My dad is a town person, but as I was growing up, I really identified with living on a farm. I had friends who lived on farms, and the town I grew up in was only 6,000 people, so you're really never that far from the country.
So you wrote, art is about land and life in the Midwest. Can you please explain what you meant by that statement?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to place myself in relationship with possibly the larger art world. So there's a lot of art now that's made in an urban setting, and whether that's a very large city or a smaller city, I think there's a different aesthetic that comes through that, and the aesthetic is very technological and busy almost, and I don't think that's bad at all, but I think that the aesthetic of the Midwest, of being able to look out over the plains and be interested by what seems like nothing, is a valuable thing, and I think it's really beautiful. So that's what I mean by life in the Midwest.
You also expressed interest in conservation and land management. How do you see making art as a catalyst for living in balance with the land?
Yeah, I think that art is a really interesting thing to have in your life, because art can be something that sort of confirms what you already believe and what you already know, or art can be something that inspires you to think new things or to, you know, to live a new way. And the best art, I think, is a mixture of those two things, because art needs to identify with you. Like, imagery should be something you understand so that you have somewhere to grab yourself in it. Right, yeah. So you have somewhere to grab onto and something to think about and somewhere to grow from. But I don't think art should be easy or something that, you know, you look at it and you're like, oh, I get that, and you turn around and go somewhere else, do something else, and don't think about it again.
So a lot of the images in your work are of buildings and landscapes that look like they could be in the past. How do you avoid turning these artworks into nostalgia?
I think about using past imagery as actually a way for myself to grow in the future. So in a lot of my work, I'm trying to combine a historical image with a more contemporary image or a contemporary thought. So actually my process when I'm making the work is I have a file of photos in my computer that I've taken and I kind of store them. And I actually go back and pick photos out of there that are important to me. So in a way, they're a little bit nostalgic, but I pick them because they're interesting to my life now. Another way that they're trying to avoid the nostalgia is I'm working in an alternative antique photo media, but I'm trying to use it in new ways. So that gives it a new flavor.
You use a process called cyanotype.
Yes.
You explain what that is?
Cyanotype is, it was invented in 1840, along with a lot of other photo processes. They were kind of going all out and mixing things together in their basements and coming up with crazy concoctions that some of them worked and some of them didn't. The cyanotype process is actually what we know as the blueprint process, so for architectural blueprints. And we don't do that anymore with digital printers, but 30 years ago, that was the industry standard. And the reason it never caught on as a photo medium, or like nobody made a photo album full of cyanotypes, was because it's blue. So I've there have been people researching cyanotype in recent years, and there are ways you can change the color by dipping it in tea, for example. Wine tannin will change the color to more purple-brown rather than bright, bright blue.
Can you describe a little bit what you actually do to create the image?
Yeah, it's kind of a long process, but I take a digital photo, and I actually have like a professional digital camera that I use, and then I take the pictures, put them in Photoshop, and manipulate them so that they're a negative, so I reverse the values, turn them black and white. And sometimes I'll do a little bit of tweaking to make it turn out better when it's finally printed. And I print them on a transparency. So then I contact print them, which means you take the transparency, put them over sensitized paper, which I hand sensitize, and put them in the sun for about 15 minutes. Today it's cloudy, so it would be longer, like 30 minutes. But the UV light exposes the cyanotype, and then you wash it in water, and it's done.
Wow. So it's a relatively simple process, actually, once you've created the digital image.
Yeah. The processing is one of the most eco-friendly, actually, of the antique photo processes. Photo processing, historically, is really quite toxic. So.
Yeah. So you can put this on a canvas? And it'll work?
Yeah, the cyanotype can stick to anything that's organic in nature. So I'm using cotton fabric. I've used oak panel. And I can use paper, obviously.
And then it's a permanent image.
Yeah, it's very permanent. It's actually one of the more... It's actually a really interesting thing about cyanotype is that if you put it in the sun for a year or something, it'll fade out. But if you go take that print and put it in a closet in the dark, it'll come back. So it lasts a long time.
Can you describe maybe one of your paintings, how you combine an image like that, a photographic image, with something that you also paint?
Yeah. You mentioned that when I take the pictures and actually print out the negative, it's really a quick process after that. So I will sensitize a piece of paper or whatever I'm printing on. I'll sensitize it multiple times and expose it multiple times. So at Stomping Grounds, if you happen to go see it, I have some larger pieces, and those are multiple exposures with multiple negatives. So I'll sensitize the paper. I use a lot of water when I put the chemical down, so it kind of looks like watercolor. I'll let it dry, expose it, wash it, let that dry, and then put more chemical down and expose it with another negative. And I'm using two chemical processes sometimes. I use also Van Dyck, which is a really similar thing to cyanotype, just adding one or two different chemicals to make a different color. So I'll do multiple exposures. The chemicals sort of cancel each other out sometimes, so you get really unexpected effects. So it's fun to work with because I can't quite predict it all the time, but I can work with it. It's like you can learn to predict the weather, or you can learn to predict the tides, but you can't control those things. So that's, I sort of liken my process to that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of an interesting example that visual artists generally are not the dreamers that they're often stereotyped as. We're often stereotyped as. Actually, doing visual art is a very practical and often somewhat scientific process.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I looked at your website.
Mm-hmm.
In your website, you have a number of headlines like Restless Tenants, All That May Be, All That Was, Meanderings. Are these series?
Yeah, I have a variety of different series there, yep.
Can you describe how you create a series?
Yeah, I think the title of the series, some of those series, came about when I was writing my thesis. I got my master's degree at Iowa State University. I graduated last year. So when I was working on some of my work for my thesis show, I was trying to figure out, I had different goals in mind when I was working on some of the different pieces, but I couldn't quite figure out what they were until I decided to put them in series. So there's a series that's on oak panel, and they're primarily photographs from my grandma's farm. And that's the All That Was series. And it's called that because it's about my history and it's about my past, and I'm sort of thinking about the implications for those. So I have the photo, and then I actually have an oil painting that I put around the background, so the photo gets its own little world that it exists in. And the background is in the landscape, might have a thunderstorm in it, or it might be a clear sky, and that kind of has a implication for my mood or how I feel about the photograph. So then there's the All That May Be series, and that's sort of a conversation with the All That Was series, because it's taking some of those images and trying to apply them. And I'm thinking about what it might be in the future, or what they mean to me now, what these people in my past mean to me. The Restless Tenants series is the most recent series that I've been working on lately, and sort of carrying on from my previous series, thinking about how I've been a urban person most of my life, actually. And I've spent some time renting and thinking about how you think about a rental property versus your own property, because we just bought a house, me and my husband did. So, like, having dreams and plans for your house versus having dreams and plans for your rental property, like, that's a big contrast. So thinking about how you carry on and how your life changes. Mm-hmm. Or maybe should it change if you're living in a rental property? I don't know.
So we're talking with Naomi Friend, who's an artist and a student at Iowa State University, who is currently has an exhibit at the Stomping Ground Cafe, which really caught my attention because of the kind of focus and beauty of the work. Can you share with us anything that you've learned from doing this work that really stays with you?
Yeah, I think I've learned a lot about myself. I think I've learned, I think about when I started working with images from maybe my grandma's farm, I had this idea that I need to go back to my grandma's farm and try and resurrect it to what it was in the 1950s. And I think I've learned a lot about how that would or wouldn't work. And what that means to my aesthetic is like being able to accept that we've done some things in our past that we regret, and listening to this segment about the passenger pigeon, thinking about how we've been able to kill off an entire species and other species. That I just read yesterday that in 2006 the river dolphin in South America went extinct. Mm. So, you know, we've managed to do this on a level we don't want to think about, and coming to terms with those things, and then being able to move on and being able to think about how are we going to pick up from where we've brought ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Any plans of your own?
Yeah. I mentioned we just bought a house, and I'm, you know, continuing to make art, but we're also starting a yupik flower farm out there. So
a yupik what?
A yupik flower farm. So we've got like 400 tulips planted right now.
Nice.
They're still frozen, obviously.
So your show will be up for how long at Stomping Grounds?
Taking it down next week, Friday.
Okay, so the artwork can be seen until not this Friday, but next Friday.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, and for another week.
Yep.
And is your work for sale?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So thank you for joining us. You do have a website.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us the website?
It's naomifriend.com, so N-A-O-M-I, friend, like a friend, .com.
So naomifriend.com.
Yep.
And on the website, you also do have paintings.
I do.
Which are very beautiful, a lot of sky and grass.
Yes, thank you.
So thank you for joining us, and good luck with your plans.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Local Talk on Community Radio. In the last portion of this hour, Roxanne Thompson interviews Tricia Crane, Executive Director of the ARC of Story County, to introduce you to the services offered by this organization. Roxanne is one of the hosts of KHOI's Community Service Appreciation Project, and this month we will be featuring the ARC of Story County. Let's listen to their conversation.
You are listening to Community Service Appreciation on KHOI FM Radio. This program features agencies and organizations that provide valuable services to our community members. This is Roxanne Thompson, and I am your host for today's show. Today's program recognizes the ARC of Story County. The ARC of Story County is an advocacy-based nonprofit organization that provides services by partnering with local businesses, providers, and community members to enrich the lives of people with disabilities. We will be speaking with Tricia Crane, the Executive Director of the ARC. Welcome, Tricia. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you, Roxanne.
Tricia, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I have been with the ARC for about 2.5 years. Prior to that, I have always been in the disability arena field here in Story County. I graduated from Iowa State with my degree in social work and have never left the county in regards to providing services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, whether that be in children's services or adult services, working both with community-based services, employment, and now with the ARC providing an array of services, social and recreational activities, and advocacy services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
That's great. I bet the ARC is very happy that you've joined their organization. You have lots of good experience.
Well, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the ARC of Story County?
Yes. To me, the history obviously is fascinating. It was started in 1953 by a core group of parents who felt they needed community-based services for their children with disabilities. And if you can imagine, back in the early 1950s, the only place for their children to live would have been at Woodward State Hospital School, Glenwood State Hospital School, definitely not in a community-based setting. And though it took them about 20 years to get those services in place, they were very proactive in getting that done. And knowing that the ARC is a national-based organization with its roots being in advocacy, each ARC has its own little niche. There are 14 ARCs in the state of Iowa, and every single one of us is different. And not every county is supported by an ARC, which is really too bad. But we were fortunate enough to have this core group of families that started Mainstream Living, which is now probably the largest community-based offering living accommodations to people with disabilities in Story County. And the ARC's niche is that we also have what is called our Active Lifestyles Program, which provides social and recreational opportunities for people with disabilities. Our goal is to have an activity going on every single night of the week for our participants and our athletes to choose from. There are counties that don't have this type of program, and so therefore when their consumers or participants go home at the end of the day from their day program or their working situation, they really don't have anything to do at night. So we take a lot of pressure off of the community-based living providers here in town by offering these programs. And it provides a lot of opportunity for volunteerism, and plus it integrates our people with disabilities into the community and makes them a contributing member to society.
Thank you. That's very informational. Tricia, you mentioned some of the activities that the ARC provides to community members and families. Can you talk a little bit more about the specific programs and any events that you offer?
Certainly. The mainstay of the Arc of Story County is our Active Lifestyles program, which I mentioned. People involved in our Active Lifestyle program are making healthy living choices, building relationships with others, and of course, having fun. We are affiliated with Special Olympics of Iowa, so we provide athletic training in bowling, volleyball, flag football, basketball, cheerleading, track and field, cycling, soccer, swimming. It goes on and on. We're always looking for volunteers for coaching. We go to all of the Special Olympic district and state competition. We have social dances, walking group, a cooking class that takes place once a week. We have faith fellowship, which is an ecumenical outreach in collaboration with area churches and volunteers for older teens and adults. Faith fellowship provides an atmosphere in which their faith can be nourished and they can have another social opportunity to interact with their peers. We have Best Buddies in affiliation with Iowa State University. It's a student-run organization at Iowa State that pairs individuals with disabilities with Iowa State students to form friendships, attend events, and participate in activities throughout the year. We have a transportation training that is offered. It provides training and support for individuals to successfully and independently access SciRide throughout Ames. And then lastly, we provide respite funding. Respite funding is designed to provide families with a short-term financial assistance when needed to care for a family member. And we have two different funding sources for this. One is our asset funding source through Story County, the City of Ames, and the United Way. And then we also have what is called the Children at Home Grant, which provides as needed financial assistance to parents of children with disabilities. And this can also pay with trips to the doctor, therapy services, any type of home modification. So yeah, we have a whole multitude of services that we can offer through the Arc of Story County.
Boy, Tricia, you've shared all the services that you provide. Do you have any idea how many participants you serve?
We had a record number of participants register with us this fall. We are currently up to 160 athletes and participants who are actively involved in our programs. We service around 50 different families with regards to our respite funding and Children at Home grant. So we really are able to reach every corner of the county.
You mentioned the respite service, and that sounds like a very valuable service to families that are trying to care for their child at home. Is there a cost to families for that?
There is no cost associated. The family needs to have a net income of below $60,000 per year, but otherwise there's no cost associated to them. I mean, it's up to us to provide the funds to the family so that they have no costs.
I read on your website that the ARC provides advocacy for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Can you tell us a bit about that work?
Sure. The ARC is known to be the nationally based organization that provides advocacy services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so what that means is that we work diligently to preserve and protect the fundamental rights and support legislation that impacts employment, housing, and other civil rights of people with disabilities. Now, locally, that may mean that a family member may call the office because they feel that their child is not getting the inclusion they need at school, and they may invite me to come to one of the IEP meetings. Or a family member may feel that their child was inappropriately dismissed from a job and would like to get us involved in regards to finding out really what took place. Was there anything that had to do with the Americans with Disabilities Act? Are all the accommodations being met either at school, in an employment situation, in a housing situation that makes sure that the participant is able to live the least restrictive life possible?
And when you get involved like that, do you feel like you make a difference?
Oh, certainly. Yes. Really, it's what makes a difference. You know, we always say that their living situation may change, their employment situation may change, but everyone always knows that the ARC's services remain stable. We're always here to provide a quality service and to support those with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
You have seen changes when you attend meetings or talk with employers?
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not here to be the ADA police by any means, but, you know, just providing that second voice for the family and or the employee or participant makes a big difference.
Does the ARC have volunteer opportunities for community members to become involved with your organization?
Well, yes, we do, Roxanne. Obviously, we rely on all volunteers to provide all of our coaching. Besides myself, we have a part-time program coordinator that is normally an Iowa State student that coordinates all the activities in the evenings. So we rely completely on volunteers to coach all of our activities that we have going on. So if a community member, college student has a particular interest in a sport that they were great in high school and or college, we probably have that available. Mm-hmm. We have our social dances that we need set up and tear down for, our cooking class. We have things available to do in the office that I can't always get done, whether people are good with the computer. They're always looking for new best buddies at Iowa State. Mm-hmm. If there's an Iowa State student out there that wants to get in contact with best buddies, we rely on volunteers to provide the transportation training when a participant asks for it. We do all of the necessary background checks with the federal government and with the state to ensure that all of our volunteers are licensed and authorized to be a volunteer with people with disabilities.
And do you have a good number of volunteers from the community involved?
We do. Obviously, Iowa State is wonderful, particularly the sororities and fraternities. We're very closely associated with a couple fraternities here at Iowa State that provide a bulk of our volunteers for all of our coaching, but we're always looking to diversify and get new coaches.
Great. Are there other ways besides volunteering that the work of the ARC can be supported by our community?
Certainly. You know, every spring, you'll find us at all of the grocery stores one Saturday in May, handing out Tootsie Rolls. That specifically, some people may think they're giving to the State Special Olympics Organization, but that goes directly here to the ARC of Story County. We have our annual fundraiser in March, along with the volunteering that we need for several of our various competitions and practices that we hold. It's just our fundraising effort. You know, we do receive funding through Asset. We do mailings throughout the year. We have a vehicle donation program that if someone has a vehicle that they would like to get rid of, even if it's not running, they just fill out a simple form on our website and the tow truck or other people come and pick it up. It's very easy. We've gotten, I think, three vehicles so far, or we received three vehicles last year. Every little bit makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Tricia, you mentioned funding from, I believe it's an acronym, ASSET. Can you tell us who is involved with the ASSET process?
Right. Those of us in Story County who work for a nonprofit are so fortunate that we have the ASSET process here in Story County. No other county in the state has this type of funding available to them. Through ASSET, the ARC itself receives funding from Story County, United Way of Story County, the City of Ames. So we receive from those three entities. However, Government of Student Body and Department of Human Services is also involved in the asset funding process. Because we don't necessarily have constituents involved with those other two entities, we don't receive funding from them.
Great, thanks. Tricia, how can interested community members reach or contact the ARC?
The ARC of Story County has a wonderful website that you can reach at www.thearcstory.org. Our office telephone number is 515-232-9330. And my personal email address is arcdirector, and that's ARC, at thearcstory.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Great. I think you have it covered. Thanks so much for your time, Tricia. It's been very interesting hearing about all the wonderful things that the ARC offers to our community members. You've been listening to Community Service Appreciation on KHOI FM Radio. Today we have been recognizing the ARC of Story County, an organization that advocates and provides services to enrich the lives of people with disabilities in our community. We've been speaking with Tricia Crane, Executive Director of the ARC. For more information, go to www.thearcstory.org or contact the ARC at 515-232-9330. Your comments and suggestions regarding Community Service Appreciation or any other KHOI broadcast are welcome. Please send your comments to khoiradio@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the program, please tell your friends. Thank you for listening. Until next time, keep your ears tuned to KHOI Community Radio.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today, during our show, Pat Schlarbaum related the story of the extinction of the passenger pigeons with help of KHOI reader James Winter, in anticipation of a lecture called The Extinction of the Passenger Pigeon. The lecture will be presented by Stanley Temple, Senior Fellow and Science Advisor with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Mr. Temple will be speaking tomorrow, March 6th, at the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 7 p.m.
Also, our artist Naomi Friend joined us in the studio to talk about her artwork, now on display at the Stomping Grounds Cafe at the corner of Welch Avenue and Hunt Street. You can also see her beautiful artwork at NaomiFriend.com. That's NaomiFriend.com.
Roxanne Thompson interviewed Tricia Crane, Executive Director of the Arc of Story County, as a part of this month's Community Service Appreciation Project. You can find out more about this organization at thearcstory.org.
Local Talk has been engineered by Richard Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelly. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. You can also listen to the show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. Becca, during this hour, you gave an announcement to us while we were listening to a recording. Can you share with us what you told me?
Oh, yeah. I got into grad school at Iowa State. Yay!
Congratulations. What are you going to be studying?
In the College of Design, it's a brand new program. It's called a Master's of Sustainable Environments. So it'll be starting in the fall.
So you'll have to let us know about that as it progresses.
Indeed.
And we're thrilled because it means we get to keep Becca in Ames and keep her at KHOI. So congratulations,
yay.
Becca.
Do what I can. Remember to sign up for Ames Trivia Night, a fun and fundraiser for KHOI and the National Alliance for Mental Illness.
Put together a team of up to 8 friends, and the team with the best name and costumes does get a prize. The winning team will receive $200 and free registration for next year's Trivia Night. This is going to be an annual event. This is a partnership between KHOI and NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And, of course, there will be a gourmet dessert auction. There'll be a whole lot of fun to keep NAMI serving the mentally ill and for KHOI staying on the air. So we hope to see you there.
It's happening this Saturday night from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Boys and Girls Club. For more information and to register, go to khoifm.org or call us at 292-2878.
That's 292-2878. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. And if you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or through our website at khoifm.org.
Your participation as an audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.